I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. And along with saving the babies, mothers are being counseled with practical and spiritual advice to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. The goal is to save 70,000 by the end of the year, and they can't do it without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound that changes everything. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. Glad to be with you today on this edition of the program. Well, each Friday, we typically have Chris Woodward in with us, but he is traveling international in the nation of Israel. And so we're going to have another guest with us here in just a little while to take Chris's place, and then hopefully Chris will be back with us next week. All right, jumping into the scripture for this week, we've been in Proverbs chapter 22, looking at verse 1 and verse 2. A good name is to be more desired than great wealth. Favor is better than silver and gold. The rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the maker of them all. So in a world that is obsessed with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and so-called equality, the great equalizer is the fact that we are all born into sin and we are all in need of a Savior. That's what Proverbs 22, verse 1, and specifically verse 2 is alluding to. The rich and the poor have a common bond, and the Lord is the maker of them all. All right, that's our scripture for the week. The Weekend with AFA event, we're going to close registration probably in the next 3 to 4 weeks, but this event, for now, registration is still open. The Weekend with AFA, it's going to be here in the city of our national headquarters, Tupelo, October 2nd through the 4th, coming up this fall. And we're going to have some very good speakers, and I'm not talking about myself or my brother or anybody else. I'm talking about the likes of Jerry Boyer, who actually is going to be on with us today. He's going to be in here with our Weekend with AFA. We're going to have, let's see, Abe Hamilton is going to be with us, Jenna Ellis, Tim Barton of Wall Builders, J.J. Jasper is going to be with us, all for the Weekend with AFA, October 2nd through the 4th at Kingfisher Lodge here in Tupelo, Mississippi. So we'd love to have you October 2 through 4. And you can go over to afa.net/weekend to check out all the information, afa.net/weekend to check out all of the information and to register and get the itinerary. All right, moving into some of the stories I want to get to today, situation with President Trump attempting to get a peace deal brokered between the Ukrainians and the Russians continues to progress. And it's you know, after the summit with Putin and then the meeting at the White House with the European leaders, including Zelensky, things were looking good. Things were looking optimistic. Who knows how this will pan out? Who knows if this so-called peace deal will actually come to fruition? You know, President Trump is at a disadvantage in many regards, or in one regard specifically that I'm thinking about, because he wants peace. He's articulated that numerous times. But when you have parties, one or the other, that don't want peace, then it's at some point the president is out of options. And I think we're getting close to that, if not already being there. I think that you're going to have Zelensky and Putin want peace. And to Trump's defense, and even Zelensky to a degree, up until now, the last 3 years, President Putin and Russia, they've shown no regard for peace, absolutely zero concern for any type of ceasefire or peace deal. As a matter of fact, Russia has bombed Ukraine during negotiations, and even while President Trump has met with other leaders, Russia keeps bombing Ukraine. And so, and the other could be said about, the same could be said about Ukraine as well. And so, ultimately, you've got to have Putin and Zelensky at the table, and they both got to agree to the terms. And I don't know if that's going to happen. It hasn't looked very promising, but who knows? We'll just have to see. What I'm curious about, though, is whether or not President Trump and the U.S. largely get to a point where they just throw their hands up, where they just say, look, we've done what we can do. We've tried our best. We've been at it for 3 years, and we've spent billions of dollars on this war, and we're out of options. I mean, we clearly want this thing to come to an end. The two parties are going to have to strike a deal, but the U.S. has done, we've exhausted all of our options on the table, and it's time for us to just pull out, to just completely withdraw from this situation. I don't know what that looks like practically. I don't know what that looks like militarily and politically, but I would say we're getting close to that. We're getting close to that, and I think that Ukraine has very little room to not want to negotiate. Ukraine has very little room to, you know, try to be stubborn in this whole deal because of how much we've helped them. You know, Ukraine really needs to just go along with what President Trump suggests and try to get a deal here. Because if it wasn't for the backing of the U.S. and some of Europe and NATO members as well, then there would Ukraine would be in a much worse place had they not been backed by the U.S. And one clip I want to play on this is the former acting attorney general under the Trump first term and current U.S. ambassador to NATO. This is Matt Whitaker talking about how President Trump wants to bring the killing to an end, and it's going to take both sides. Let's listen.
President Trump is a peacemaker, and he is mediating a brutal meat grinder war to a truce. And that's going to take some time, and both sides are going to have to give, and he's going to have to see how far both sides are willing to go. And you know, there is nobody that is better positioned and can bring the parties to the table than Donald Trump. And I think he should be given the support of really all these elected politicians that are doing nothing to help Ukraine settle this war, to help with the rebuilding of Ukraine.
Well, there you have it. That's Matt Whitaker. And to his point, you know, there hasn't really been another voice, another leading voice calling for peace. If we're being honest here, there's been Russia's basically been on an island by itself, with the exception of maybe some backing by China and North Korea, and maybe a few others. But a lot of your congressional leaders have been heavily on the side of Ukraine to such a degree that they want to the war to continue. They think that the war should continue, Lindsey Graham being one of them. And there's others. But, and so it, really President Trump is the only leader, political leader that has called for peace and the bringing of both parties to the table. Up until now, up until President Trump coming into office, it has been a lot of saber rattling, a lot of warmongering, and a lot of provocation from both sides, and very little discussion about peace. And so kudos to President Trump for wanting to bring about peace. Well, earlier in the week, we talked about the immigration issue. I spent nearly an entire show on it, and there's more to cover because these detention facilities are just popping up all around the country. Once again, this is because of the One Big Beautiful Bill. We've got roughly $50 billion at play here for these detention facilities, and that will help facilitate a large deportation operation. Maybe not the largest because the numbers aren't very impressive right now. I actually talked extensively last week about how the Trump administration really is going to have to pick up the deportation numbers. I mean, what they're doing now is just not going to cut it. There's nothing largest deportation about what's going on right now. So they're going to have to step it up. But having the housing and the facilities for this is part of the battle. So let's play clip one. This is going to be the largest ICE detention facility that has ever existed. Clip one.
The largest federal migrant detention center in American history has opened its doors. It is the latest effort to keep up with the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. The migrant processing facility in Fort Bliss, Texas, near the U.S.-Mexico border, officially opening today. And News Nation correspondent Jorge Ventura is live in Texas. Jorge, who is expected and how many are expected to pack this mega facility?
Well, Natasha, the Trump administration continues to expand their mass deportation operation. And now we are learning that Fort Bliss is set to open today as a ICE detention facility with up to 1,000 beds already ready to go. Now, what ICE says is this is part of a $1 billion project that will now reshape how migrants are detained and ultimately deported. That ICE facility opening today is part of a $1.2 billion Defense Department contract. This massive new detention complex will begin with 5,000 beds up to 2027. Now, inside that facility, detainees will have access to legal help, medical treatment areas, and recreational space amenities. ICE insists that it will make it like a traditional facility. Supporters say it's meant to ease overcrowding at other detention centers and serve as a processing hub, sending migrants with final removal orders directly onto ICE air flights back to their home countries.
Well, there you have it. One of the largest ICE detention bed facilities in American history opening up in Fort Bliss, Texas. And I said a while ago, months ago, probably last year, how there should be no flying these illegal immigrants into the homeland, into the mainland. They should stay right on the border and be housed there and processed there and have their hearing there on the border in Texas if they're crossing, assuming they're crossing the southern border. And this is going to help here. This is going to help because Fort Bliss is where? Right on the border. I mean, miles. This actual facility may not even be more than a couple miles, if not less than that, from the actual border. So this is the way to go here. You set up these ICE detention facilities all along the southern border. Then you bus the illegals once they're arrested. You bus them to the facility. And they stay there until an immigration judge has heard their case and processed them, and their final order for removal has taken place, and then, boom, it's done. No more flying them to Chicago, flying them to Atlanta, flying them to Minneapolis, flying them into San Francisco. Nope, none of that. They get apprehended at the southern border. They stay at the southern border until a immigration judge has heard the case, ruled, boom, done. Absolutely. That is the most streamlined and efficient manner to go about this. And so this is what the President Trump's administration is moving towards. That's why you have these facilities popping up in Texas. And this one specifically is right on the border. This is coming on the heels of the Trump administration beginning to transfer land ownership on the southern border to the U.S. military. I believe it was the Department of Interior that transferred land. Let's see, land transfer to Department of Defense. This was done this year in order to allow the military to patrol the border. Active duty military patrol the border. So this was in April. The U.S. Department of Interior transferred administrative jurisdiction over approximately 110,000 acres of federal land along the U.S.-Mexico border in New Mexico to the Department of Army for a three-year period, creating the New Mexico National Defense Area, which is a heightened crime when you trespass not just into the country, but also into a designated military complex. It really doubles the penalty from a federal law, immigration law standpoint. And so all of this is working to secure our country.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to be with you on today's edition of The Core. Well, welcoming back to the program a guest of the program before, Katie Tolento, Executive Director with the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. Katie's back with us. Hey, Katie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Katie, this story I wanted to get your input on and have you tell us, break this down for us, has to do with a lawsuit. The way I understand it is this is a lawsuit brought by medical associations against the Department of Health and Human Services. But instead of being brought from a liberty mindset and a mindset of individual choice and responsibility, it's actually coming at it from the opposite direction, in that all of these vaccines and these shots should be mandated, no questions asked. Am I understanding this lawsuit correctly? And break it down for us.
Yeah, well, if they were here, they would say the CDC, that recommendation, that they're not, that that's what they're suing over, is the CDC recommendation. It's not actually a mandate, it's a recommendation. And the CDC engaged in some sort of, you know, bad science and whatever, because Bobby Kennedy, you know, that's their argument. And essentially, the reason why they're wrong is that more than half of all states in their statutes actually refer back to the CDC recommendations with respect to their vaccine requirements. So vaccine requirements are set at the state level, and most states actually rely on the CDC's recommendations. So in a sense, what the CDC does really does affect mandates and what families have to do. So if the CDC recommends that, you know, all kids age 6 to 18 get the COVID vaccine, or that all babies on the first day of life get some vaccine for hepatitis B, which is a sexually transmitted disease, on the first, you know, in the first hour of life, then that is going to be what happens. And if you are a parent that is trying to choose something different for your child, you're going to be hunted down. I just had a grandchild born, and they sent CPS to our house. CPS. And so, you know, if you don't obey these rules, you can get in big trouble. So it's really important that the CDC makes sound public health, science-based decisions. And that is what they have done here for the first time with respect to the COVID vaccine, by the way. And, you know, these organizations like this Pediatrics Membership Society, which is funded almost exclusively by Big Pharma, you know, they don't like it, and their donors don't like it either.
Katie, I don't understand, though. It's so frustrating to me that the basic premise of this lawsuit is that two entities can't have differing opinions, is the way I understand it, because the American Association of Pediatrics says one thing. They're recommending the COVID shot, even though it's a very, very faulty and no science-backed opinion. But then you got the CDC and HHS, which have withdrawn their recommendation for the shot for minors. And so, to me, it's just absurd that you can launch a civil suit to force the government to alter its recommendation.
Well, it's existential for them. You have to follow the money. So pediatricians, the vast majority of what they're doing every day are well baby visits, well child visits where vaccines happen. If you didn't need to take your kid in for the vaccine schedule, you almost never need to take your kid in, right? Except when they're sick, because all these so-called checkups and wellness visits and the physicals you have to do before you go into school every year, those are all vaccine visits. And what happens to these pediatricians? So they would lose that business if parents, you know, reduce their vaccine uptake at any rate. But also, every year they get an end of year bonus from the insurers, the big insurers, based on what percent of their practice is compliant with the CDC recommendations. So they could get hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, sometimes more than they make in salary from these bonuses. All of that is at risk if people, as they have been, start choosing to delay or skip vaccines.
This, Katie, is so the end result, if these parties get what they want, would be to force RFK Jr. and his agencies that he leads as the Secretary of Health and Human Services to rescind their previous guidance that withdrew the COVID shot recommendation for minors, for infants, basically, for children, and reinstate the recommendation in favor of the shot, all because some private association of pediatrics has got their feelings hurt. I mean, this just, it doesn't seem like it's a very robust argument. I mean, basically, when you read the fouling and when you read the news stories on this, basically, the American Association of Pediatrics and other groups, other organizations that are part of this lawsuit, they're basically saying, hey, CDC, we don't agree with y'all, and you're making us look bad because we're having to explain to parents that you say one thing and we say another, so you should have to say what we say. That's basically the argument. There's no strong legal theory here. There's no harm been done. I'm just surprised this thing even made it into court.
Yeah, and I mean, this is quite a playbook. If they may rue the day. I mean, if outside entities, private organizations like, say, parents groups or COVID dissidents can sue the government and force the government to change their mind, like, great, game on.
Yeah. Duly noted. Let's give it a shot, right? But this just shows the cynicism and the audacity and the arrogance of these medical associations. And really, this is embarrassing for them, because when you read the filings on this, the court filings I'm talking about, what you draw from it is that these physicians that have signed on to this, this coalition, if you will, they're so not confident in their own medical advice that they've got to sue about it, because they've never been placed in this position in 30 plus years where their advice goes against the CDC's advice. But to me, Katie, this is good for our country. Let's have a good, honest, fair debate about whether this shot is good for our children or not. But these physicians, they don't even want to have a debate. They don't even want to have a conversation. All they want to do is say, well, the CDC says, and then give you the shot.
Well, they're used to everybody just submitting. Right. They're used to being priests and priestesses in a white coat religious cult where everyone respects their authority and does exactly as they say and doesn't question where these opinions come from and the scientific basis for them. And during COVID, which was the absolute silver lining and blessing of COVID, America and American parents woke up and started saying, you know what? Maybe my pediatrician, maybe these doctors, maybe these experts do not have the expertise that they think they do. And your average American physician or pediatrician of any sort is going to be busy all day. They're super busy. They don't have time to read every clinical trial that comes out of the pharma-funded journals. And even if they did, they don't have the training in epidemiology and biostatistics to understand whether those clinical trials are adequate or not. They get like, what, maybe 1 hour of epidemiology training in medical school. So these people are just not the experts that they love being. They love that deference. They love everybody turning to them and that authority. And when it's questioned, boy, the mask comes off.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, Katie, when push comes to shove and people start asking questions, they start sweating. They start going, well, the CDC says, or, you know, HHS says, because they don't want to have to answer the hard questions. And so they love being kind of on this perch of being the best of the best and the elite and the go-to on all things medical advice. But when there's any discrepancies or any agency disagrees, they get really nervous because, to your point, they really don't know their stuff. And I've had this experience firsthand where we're getting shots recommended for kids, and I ask questions like the Hep B, I think, is what they want to give the shot in the hospital when the child's like 24 hours old. And you ask the nurse who's going to be administering it without even the doctor around, and you go, so what does this do exactly? And they go, oh, let me go get the print off for you. And they go to the CDC website and they do a print off, and then you ask them questions. They have no idea what they're doing or what the shot does. And that just goes back to this default position that, well, you should just trust us and just do it and don't ask us any questions. Last thoughts,
well, honestly,
Katie.
There is an FDA label for all of these products. And if you ask your physician for the FDA label and you go to the section 6.1 in that label, you will see what trials were done on that product. So for the hepatitis B product, all you need to do is look and see this product was, they followed 160 kids for 5 days before they approved this product. And if that's the kind of risk you want to take with your baby on your baby's first day of life, go right ahead. You're free to do that. It's a free country. But you should not be forced to do that. And, you know, the doctors, they benefit from this. And their pharmaceutical donors of this association, they benefit from you just blindly accepting every single vaccine. And you know, you can't sue these companies if the vaccine hurts your child. You can't sue them. It's the greatest market ever. They want, I mean, what other product does the government require everyone to buy and they can't be sued if they hurt you? I mean, it's the greatest, it's a golden ticket. So yeah. That gold is being threatened, and that's the root of the problem here.
Yeah, 100%. You're right. And there shouldn't be this immunity. It just shouldn't exist. We don't have this level of immunity for hardly any other industry, and this deals directly with our health. So that shouldn't even exist. Hey, Katie, tell our folks your website where they can read more about your work.
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. We're a non-insurance alternative for getting your medical bills taken care of. And we don't force anything on you, and we protect your faith and your budget. So you can reach us at ahcsm.org.
Excellent. Hey, Katie Talento, thanks so much for coming on with me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Folks, you heard this story right. I mean, this is no joke. You would think this was like part of the Babylon Bee or something, or the Onion. This is no joke. These medical associations are suing the government. They're suing RFK Jr. and his outfit in order to force them to recommend a shot that RFK Jr. and their data says they don't have the data to back it up. They do not have the data to recommend this shot with confidence, which we all knew the whole time, but Biden's crew went along with it, regardless of the red flags. And so I don't know whether this is upsetting anybody else or just me, but this expectation of uniformity, this expectation of you're not allowed to ask questions, and this expectation of all the, quote, medical professionals all having to dance to the same tune is very concerning to me. It is very concerning that dissent is not allowed in the medical community. Like, can you imagine any other industry where dissent is treated this way? Especially with so much money at stake, dealing directly with our health and our well-being. I mean, this is, you want a red flag in any industry? You find the industry that doesn't allow any dissent amongst the professionals that make up the industry. I mean, whether we're talking about food, furniture, vehicles, any industry, lawyers, whatever industry we're talking about, there's always differing opinions. There's always differing advice. But here we are, and these medical associations are so sensitive and so insecure that they just can't fathom, how dare the CDC make a differing recommendation than we do? We've all got to be on the same page. No, no, you don't. You don't all have to be on the same page. You don't all have to be dancing to the same tune. I actually want to hear differing opinions. I want to hear people that disagree with each other and articulate your position. This is America. Let's hear it out. But these medical associations don't want it. Why? Because it threatens the bottom line. Two main drivers here, I can tell you with absolute certainty. There are two main drivers here behind the lawsuit. The first driver is this insecurity that I'm talking about, where these doctors have never been questioned in their career, and they don't want to ever be questioned in their career. They're having patients ask questions like, hey, doc, why does the CDC not recommend this and you do? Can you please explain? They don't want to be asked the questions. I've seen reports of physicians that get frustrated when patients ask questions because they don't want to have to spend their time explaining. Whoa, how much are you getting paid? And you're dealing with my health and you don't want to answer any questions? No go. The second driver is the money. These are two main drivers, almost guaranteed, is the money. As Katie said, there's an entire incentive structure, an entire financial incentive structure that rewards financially the administering of these shots. No questions asked. The more shots you administer, the more you get paid. It's a compensation package directly tethered to the administration of the shots, which I think is an ethical violation. If you want to incentivize and put a comp package together for selling a house, selling a car, selling furniture, selling tennis shoes, selling something that doesn't directly affect someone's individual health, fine. We live in a capitalist society. But I think these incentive structures for physicians, where the more medicine they give, the more shots they give, the more they get compensated. It seems very, very problematic from a conflict of interest and an ethical standpoint. And the entire incentive structure in the medical field should be completely re-examined. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the last segment of today's program here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. I'm your host for the program today. Glad to be with you here on AFR. Well, previous guest and friend of the ministry that I work with nearly weekly is Jerry Boyer of Boyer Research. He's been on before. He's also featured on Rob West program each Friday. And Jerry's back with us. Hey, Jerry, welcome back to the program.
Walker, great to be with you again.
Absolutely. Jerry, this excellent news item that developed late last week had to do with Costco pharmacies selling the abortion pill. And you and myself and dozens of others, mainly in the financial world, whether it's advisors or investment institutions, signed on to a letter, shareholders as well, signed on to a letter to Costco and others, other major pharmacy brands, to not asking them, appealing to them to not sell the abortion pill mifepristone for multiple reasons, both moral and legal. So tell us a little bit about this story.
Well, I think you've outlined the facts of the matter very well. A number of us asked them to, they were under pressure to sell mifepristone. They were under pressure from blue state financial officers, and particularly by the New York City controller. And anyone who's following the New York City politics with Mondami, et cetera, he's sort of teamed up with the New York City controller, Brad Lander. They cross endorsed one another. And so the controller of New York has essentially been using New York City pension dollars as a political weapon to buttress his credentials on the left and get him in the game. Because usually, you know, the comptroller of the pension plan isn't a mayoral candidate. That's not usually the path to becoming mayor or governor. How did he do that? He took the pension dollars of New York working people and pushed an extreme left-wing agenda. And so he pressured them. Red State Treasurers pushed back on that. I was part of that, as did a number of financial advisors and asset managers and asset owners, like American Family Association. People don't quite understand, what does that mean? Well, you have donors, for example. Donors sometimes give money, but there's some real big tax advantages to giving stock sometimes instead. So stock goes up in value, and then they can make that a donation of stock to you, and then they get a much better tax write-off. But in the meantime, what they don't realize is, in your particular case, you've got that stock, and you can use that to engage with those companies. So it's a very powerful tool. So in the case of Costco, there was a lot of pressure on them to sell the abortion drug. And a number of us came forward, including you, to basically say that this is not good business. Now, I know there's clearly a moral case against mifepristone, mm-hmm. because it's an abortifacient, and abortion is immoral. But there's also a fiduciary business case. What's the fiduciary business case? Number one, it's a lot riskier than reported. Something like 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 women end up in the emergency room if they use this. So why was it approved? Because the Biden administration politicized the FDA process and rushed through the approval. Now there's data coming out and saying it should never have been approved, that it's very dangerous. So there's a risk of being sued if you sell this stuff. There's also just a really obvious, to me, obvious business risk, which is if you kill customers, then they're not customers anymore. Hmm. So you can sell, Costco can sell mifepristone for $200 to a mother to eliminate her child. That's $200, one and done. That's the last bit of business that Costco is doing having to do with that child. Or she can have the baby, and we've calculated, actually using help from your CFO, Walter Billingsley, helped us with the data on this. We calculated the net present value of 10 years of a child being a customer. Like if you go from a family of 3 to a family of 4, $7,200 in revenue value. So you're losing $7,000 when you're paid $200 to help kill the baby, as opposed to selling diapers and Vicks and shoes and vaporizers and all the other things and tricycles and everything you sell. So it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. For whatever reason, Costco came forward and said, we're not going to sell this. So that is a reason to be very thankful. There's part of a general vibe shift, I think, that's going on, in which there's a new openness to the conservative side of the argument. And I think Costco is reflecting that, which is really interesting because Costco historically is kind of a left aligned firm. You know, the roots are Seattle, right? I mean, this isn't Walmart.
You know? Right, right.
Not somebody who, you know, had a Southern footprint. This is a very, you know, sort of Pacific Northwest footprint. Mm-hmm. But I think they saw the reality here.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe this will, you know, give some credence or some excuse to other pharmacy brands to do the same thing, because to your point, there's no strong case for selling the abortion pill. I mean, there's not, unless you're operating as like a arm of the Democrat Party and you're all in ideologically on the abortion idea, then of course it might make sense. But otherwise, there's no strong business case for selling the abortion pill, and there's a million reasons why not to. And Costco came to their senses on that, and we appreciate that. And we encourage others to do the same. Jerry, let me steal you from Rob's show because he likes to ask you about the economy. And by the time this airs, he will have already asked you about the economy. But the labor report, the jobs report, the most recent jobs report was pretty weak. It wasn't negative. And of course, we had a cooling GDP in the first quarter. Second quarter was better. How do you see all this faring out with the Trump economy? You know, inflation still, things are still expensive. And inflation really isn't below 2% in most of the major categories. So how do you see this faring out?
Yeah, inflation's closer to 3% than it is to 2%. You know, I believe personally that the proper inflation target is zero. So as far as I'm concerned, when the Fed says, you know, we want a inflation target of 2 to 2.5%, they have already very much conceded to monetary debasement. I mean, that's the basket weaving class, you know, option for them. It ought to be zero. So if we're not hitting even that permissive goal, then we got a problem. The last print was 2.7. Actually, depends whether you're looking at wholesale or retail, but generally it's been going up. So why has it been going up? Well, we had a short trade war. And we can debate whether trade war, you know, but whether that was a good policy or not. It depends, right? Sometimes it's, for some people, there should be a permanent trade war. We should have high tariffs. You know, they're going to tariff us, and each country just kind of consumes what it produces. There's another approach, which is you use reciprocal tariffs. You use tariffs as a negotiating tool. The president seems to have focused more on tariffs as a negotiating tool. At least that's my read. He's got advisors who want a kind of fortress, permanent trade war, and he's got advisors who want more trade and use tariffs against other countries to get them to open up their markets to us. So there was a period of time when we had a pretty aggressive trade war in place. And when we get these numbers from the government, people have to realize, you'll even see the headlines like, well, inflation is now trending upwards. Well, wait a minute, it's August. That was July, right? Or GDP, you know, it was 3% or what, 0.5%. Well, you know, that's second quarter, right? Yeah, that's 2 months ago, basically. So one of the problems when we get economic news, when you get GDP news or inflation or employment news, it is at least a month out of date. So we're kind of like looking back in the time machine to when the trade war was still rolling on. Now that the trade war is mostly off, then, you know, things I think are more likely to get better. So we had negative growth in the first quarter. Well, basically we were 180% tariffs, you know, on the world. Well, it's no surprise that was disruptive, right? And it's no surprise that if you're taxing these transactions, that you're going to get some higher prices. I think the question is, now that we've moved into sort of a more normalizing of that, what do we see going forward? And I think we'll see better news going forward.
One last question. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left, Jerry, is on the how long it takes to get to gain what was lost from the COVID era. Because you look at the wages that were lost and just how people's income was just eaten by inflation. I think it's going to be towards the tail end, best case scenario, towards the tail end of this term, of President Trump's term, before we're at any place that is close to where we were before. Some people say we'll never go back. I'm not going to say that. But don't you think that a full recovery is going to take several years?
Yeah, I do. I think it's going to take time. COVID was very disruptive. By the way, I think the most disruptive thing about COVID wasn't COVID.
Right.
The most disruptive thing about COVID was our reaction to it.
Yeah.
Broad-based lockdowns. I mean, for thousands of years, the principle on plagues is you quarantine the sick, you don't quarantine the healthy.
Correct.
It is a very odd thing that we quarantined an entire global civilization, as opposed to, say, people in nursing homes, people who maybe had diabetes, people with advanced heart disease, people who are immunocompromised. So that was a very strange response. So what that did is that created almost a complete shutdown of the economy. So what do we do in response to that? We ramp up spending and we ramp up money supply creation. So that was, you know, that was inflationary and it was contractionary. So when do we climb out of that hole? Well, there's kind of two things here. One is, you know, I think we can kind of be back to where we were before, really about now, but we're never going to be back to where we would have been. I mean, if somebody is a distance runner and they fall and break their leg severely and they're laid up for 6 or 8 months, that's lost. Now, they can be runners again, and maybe they can eventually get back, but that's a year loss in their career. So we wiped out 2 years of America's economic preeminence. Now, the rest of the world did as well, sure. So we're still preeminent. But doing something like that, you never make up for the mistake. In time, you can get back to where you were,
yeah,
but you can never make up those lost years. Unless, I mean, in God's providence, you know, was the prophet Joel, the Lord will restore the years the locusts have eaten. What I would say to that is that's a miraculous gift and I pray for it, but there's no policy mix or no amount of effort that's going to restore the years that the locusts have eaten. Those years are lost.
I agree.
Of a terrible policy mistake.
Yeah, and that's why we should never forget how that was all drastically mishandled, and we should never go back and do that again. Terrible, terrible thing. And I still think there's a whole lot of lack of accountability in response to the whole COVID mania. There was just a lot of things done very wrong. I'm not just talking policy. I'm talking very evil things that were done that nobody really answered for. We just kind of moved on. For better or worse. Hey, Jerry, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate your input on all these various items, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you, Walker.
All right. That's Jerry Boyer of Boyer Research. And this Costco story is a big, big story, and I just can't highlight it enough. That's why I wanted to have Jerry on, because the coalition of investors and advisors that are working in this space are just doing phenomenal work, and they don't make headlines every day, and that's fine. We don't need to. But the fact that we have faith-based investors and faith-based financial advisors and people that are Christian in the financial world that are paying attention to how these companies operate, these multi-billion dollar companies, is something we just haven't had in the past at this scale. And we're seeing great, great fruit, great, great results. And any ministry that's listening out there that has any money in investments ought to be paying attention to this topic. Because if we can get, and we've already gotten, we're already into the billions as far as assets under management, owned and managed by Christian ministries and organizations and businesses that are in this coalition. But there's billions at more at play. Anybody who's listening, whether an individual or a private or a nonprofit or an organization or even a private faith-based business that has investments, any semblance of investments, ought to be paying attention to the companies that they're investing in. And not just paying attention to, but showing up at shareholder meetings and engaging at the corporate level with these corporations. Christians ought to be showing up at the board meetings. That's a fact. And that's what we're doing as of the last 2 years. Jerry's team over at Boyer Research, they're experts in this. This is what they do. We work with them every week, every month on this, looking at different shareholder opportunities, looking at different board meetings that we can show up at. And I've spoken at Bank of America, I've spoken at Apple, I've spoken at Chase, I've spoken at Meta, and the list goes on, and we're able to speak Christian values into the corporate boardroom of America's Fortune 10 companies. And that's only possible because of your support and those of you who donate stock and other gifts to the ministry. So thank you so much. We're going to pledge to keep up the work. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.